You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 20th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Vox senior correspondent Ian Millhiser. As the Supreme Court sets the table to expand a religious powers and contract Trump's accountability. Meanwhile, Mike Pompeo's spending draws attention, but it turns out he fired that inspector general. They started facing questions on that emergency arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Mutiny for bounty. Swing state Democrats and progressives take on Pelosi on Pramila Jayapal's paycheck protection plan. And the plaintiff, Jane Roe from V. Wade, apparently made a deathbed confession. She faked her abortion rights reversal for money. Tattoos, hairdos, no problem. But the Georgia governor cancels the state Supreme Court elections so he can just appoint one. Meanwhile, airlines slash their flights, pack in customers like sardines, sardines that are living in a world where there's no pandemic. Trump doesn't want to extend unemployment benefits, but he does want to cut health and safety regulations across the board. Meanwhile, new research shows climate change is definitely making hurricanes stronger. And Trump is pissed that Michigan has vote by mail, and now Texas does too. And speaking of Texas, congratulations, Texans. You can now be evicted again because supposedly all of this is over. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for joining us. We have a short show for you today. I mean, let me put it this way. I shouldn't even say that. We have a show that is basically the length of every other show that exists, except for ours today. Shorten one in part because we're trying to make up. We never had our April vacation this year. Of course, it's not like we're going to go anywhere. A combination of that and, frankly, things in on my end are a little bit more complicated at the moment. We have a someone is quarantining, and so I am solo with my children, and it is things are starting to fray a little bit, if you know what I mean. Well, today we'll have Ian Millhiser, and that'll be it. We'll be back live again tomorrow, and then Friday, and then Monday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just want to remind you, this program, we had a little bit of excitement around here yesterday, right? Because we had some announcements, and I want to make this, this is the official announcement. Darn it, I don't have my board up. The official announcement of the launch of the much anticipated. I mean, I feel like we've had merch in the past, but very just sporadically. Never had a merch store. But now, ladies and gentlemen, we do. If you go to shop.majorityreportradio.com, that is shop, as in I'm going shopping. Shop.majorityreportradio.com, you will see that we now have a merch store. We got t-shirts. We got hat. We got hoodie. We have masks that say, your mask protects me, my mask protects you. Those things are selling like hotcakes. And we should tell you that all the proceeds for that go to the Northwest Immigration Services. And we tried to keep the prices low. I mean, this is not a, we don't anticipate making a lot of money off this. Although, I mean, if it may be, who knows? But this is really, folks have been wanting merch for a long time. And Brendan, you know, I basically, Brendan was here, and so he was able to do it. If it was just by my own designs, it would have never, ever, ever, ever happened. So thank you, Brendan. Thanks for the guys over at our shop. And it's all union made, all American made, all union printed. So have at it. Also want to thank our newest sponsor, Sunset Lake CBD. Folks apparently went crazy yesterday with the CBD. They're a family-owned dairy farm. They started off by making milk. Well, not just milk. They didn't make milk.
Cows
producing milk, right? They produce milk for Ben and Jerry's, and then they decided to diversify a couple years ago and started growing hemp. And UVM uses their farm as a research plot to, they're working on preserving soil. I mean, they're just an incredibly responsible grower, 100% pesticide free. They use organic fertilizers. Also, they pay, their minimum wage is $15 an hour. The company is majority owned by employees, and they have all sorts of different CBD products. They have stuff that you smoke, like this special sauce I'm holding here. That's one of the brand. That's one of the names. I haven't quite figured it out. I haven't smoked enough to get the sense. And then Keef. What is Keef?
Keef, Matt? Keef is the bit that when you grind up, you know, flour, part falls through the vent underneath, and it's very fine particles, and it's more potent, and that's the good stuff. So yeah, they give you these little things of keef too, and in addition, so this is my cherry, or what kind of this? I don't know. I can't see the brand now.
A little bit early, don't you think? I mean, anyways, but it is you don't get obviously there's no psychoactive a part of this. There's no THC. But you don't want to smoke. They've got gummies, they got tincture. That's what I've been hitting hard. And I've been doing the 750 mil, but they also have like a, I think it's like a 1250, 1250, mil. And, it's been helping me sleep. I found it to be incredible in terms of helping me to sleep. I'm sort of shocked, to be honest with you. They also have a salve if you have sore muscles. The other thing I really like is the CBD, coffee. It's my weekend coffee. During the week, I'm doing just coffee. During the weekend, I hit my CBD coffee and I'm going to try and smoke a little bit of this. Apparently Matt is finding it, to be a good complement to other things that one might put in a pipe and smoke, as it were. Indeed. Also, here's the other, part that's great. They give you 20% off with the coupon code Left Is Best. Left Is Best. So it's sunsetlakecbd.com. sunsetlakecbd.com. I'd like to take a trip up to that farm, to be honest with you. That's what I might do. All right, let's go to some sound clips here. Let's play. should we start with Costco Tyson? Yeah. Is that his name, Costco Tyson? Oh, okay. Oh, he's the worker. Oh, okay, good. So here's the deal. There's all these videos now that are showing up of people who are just sort of like annoyed that they have to wear a mask in businesses. I mean, it's like, it's annoying to me that if I see you out and about on the street, let's say, you know, you're not wearing a mask, I'm annoyed. What am I going to do? But the idea that you could go into a business without a mask, and you think it's your right, that there is some type of right about it. This is what's so fascinating about these. the level of aggrievement amongst people of this ilk is just stunning to me. But here is this viral video that's going around now, that I guess was shot by the perp, as it were, and he thinks that he's getting the better end of this, and it doesn't really turn out to be that case.
I just put you on my 3,000 follower Instagram feed, mostly locals.
Hi everyone, I work for Costco and I'm asking this member to put on a mask because that is our company policy.
Pause it for 1 second.
I like it. I'm not doing it.
He's the club he's using here. The guy is his 3,000 follower Instagram feed. We have such a demented society, right? Where it's just like. Like, this is like high school, right? Junior high, even.
I say, sir, I have 20,000 followers on Twitter. Do you know who you've crossed?
Exactly. But it's like, I'm going to intimidate you with my 3,000 Instagram followers. Well, sir, if you had said Pinterest, maybe I would be a little bit concerned. But all right, go ahead, play this.
Because that is our company.
Oh, go back. So go back. I
just put you on my 3,000 follower Instagram feed. Mostly local.
Hi, everyone. I work for Costco, and I'm asking this member to put on a mask because that is our company policy. So either wear the mask.
And I'm not doing it because I woke up in a free country.
Have a great day.
So you're going to take this car from me.
Sir, have a great
full
day.
Full of stuff.
You are no longer welcome here in our warehouse. You need to leave. Thank you very much.
You put it on. I'll give you my card. He's going to take the card away because he's a pussy little bitch. Mm. There he is, walking away with all my stuff. There he goes. Because I'm not a fucking sheep.
He's not a sheep. He's not
and
a
so
sheep.
And so all these people wearing masks.
We're all sheep. We're just wearing the masks because we were told to. Nobody had to explain to us that there's science involved or that we breathe out the virus if we are asymptomatic and we don't realize it, that doing this and talking and particularly like is basically projecting out to everybody the virus that we may have. It's just that no, we were just told to wear the mask. We're sheep. And he does a follow up, this guy, because apparently he thought that his 3,000 Instagram viewers were also morons like him, and they all just started celebrating the Costco worker. Play his response to his own video that he played. And
what?
Now, listen, hold on. I just want to tell people this is not necessarily safe for work because we see the top of his shoulders, and I feel already scarred. Frankly, but go ahead.
What up, everybody? It's your favorite Reddit public freak out fucking villain, all right? And I'm gonna tell you this. One, yeah, I'm a little fat, I get that. Two, I've got every fucking right to not wear a mask anywhere because this isn't about wearing a mask, this is about control, okay? And I'm not the fucking sheep. Y'all are the fucking sheeps, every single one of you, going along with what everybody else is saying. I was one of the only people in that store not wearing a mask, which means you're protected from me and I'm protected from you, okay? That dude was hovering over me.
Pause
he was
it for
stalking
a second.
Me. He
Pause
was
it
fuck-
for a second. No, people are not protected from you. He doesn't get it. That's actually, this is a good time for me to plug the Majority Report masks, which say, my mask protects you. Your mask protects me. He is endangering everybody. He is getting protection from those masks that everybody else is wearing. That's the thing that he does not understand. Because his brain is actually like that of a sheep. He is being protected by all those other people. They're doing the work to protect him. He just doesn't want to do the work to protect anybody else. And then I love the fact that in some way, like, because I'm an American, I have the right to go into a private business. And like, well, why didn't you go in without your shirt on too? Or your shoes, right? I mean, doesn't everybody realize like, no shirt, no shoes, no service? Well, in this instance, they have the right to also say mask. But continue.
You're protected from me and I'm protected from you, okay? That dude was hovering over me, he was stalking me, he was fucking with me. I just took out my camera at that moment so I could show people how this guy was acting towards one person, okay? So if everyone else is wearing a mask, then one person should be able to fly, if anything. This isn't about the mask, it's about control, okay? You need to get that through your thick heads and realize that I'm not the fucking sheep, okay? I was the only one not wearing a mask in that thing. I'm saying that again, okay? The only fucking one. So everybody else is the sheep.
That's what you
and all
attention.
You people in the comments, right. You guys are the fucking sheep. Look at your comments. I'm the only one that sticks out from all of you fucking liberals. And yes, this is a partisan issue. So, leave me your fucking comments and talk shit to me there in the comments, and I'll respond to you as much as Reddit will let me. Peace out.
So it turns out to be a political issue, because we all know that conservative values are that you cannot, that property owners of a store cannot control who comes into their place of business. I just the ignorance there, and like, well, I don't even get like, what do you guys think that what point do you think he's making that he was the only one?
I think he's just addicted to posting, really. I think he just wants to stir controversy, because he's like, I will reply to all of your comments.
Well, he knows, like, next time I go into Costco, I'm gonna have 5,000 Instagram followers.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm waiting to see what they do in that instance.
It's crazy he doesn't understand that it'd make his case better if there was like a couple other guys that also weren't married wearing masks. So like old ladies or something, and they weren't harassed. But it's, I was the only one flaunting the rules of this private establishment, and they took issue with it.
It's just bizarre to me. But there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to America. I got one more video I want to play in a moment, but I should also tell you this episode is brought to you by Magic Spoon. This stuff is, I'm a little bit blown away by it. I had some this morning, and the thing is that my kids really love it. It's what they do is, and it's funny because Saul is the same age that I was when I had these cereals, right? Like, I don't know if I'm supposed to say what they are, but you know, the one that with the toucan, that guy, what he sold the Fruity Soup. And then there was Count Chocula or something. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that. I don't know. But you realize when you look back on all these cereals that they're just full of garbage, right? All sugar, all junk. Magic Spoon is a new cereal company that's discovered a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals with, you ready for this? Zero sugar, 12 grams of protein, and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. Magic Spoon offers 4 flavors based on the all-time classics, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry, plus a variety pack that lets you try them all. So far, we've just had the cocoa and the fruity and the frosted. In our house, we have not cracked open the blueberry, but I mean, my kids are going crazy for them, and I love them too. And it's weird because you feel like you're eating garbage, but you're not. It's keto friendly, it's gluten free, it's grain free, it's soy free, it's low carb and GMO free. For me, so far I'm the cocoa, but Saul had me on the fruity today, and it's delicious, and there's no sugar. I guess it's like monk fruit. Have you guys ever had monk fruit?
Yes.
The
yeah,
sweetness
it
comes.
It's
the sweetness
remarkable.
Comes from some type of monk fruit extract. It's crazy, but it's delicious. The cereals are delicious, and you know it's healthy. Protein, no sugar, small amount of carbs. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Grab a variety pack. Try it today. Use the promo code MajorityReport at checkout to get free shipping. I'm telling you, my kids love this stuff, and I'm super psyched because there's basically like, I don't know, you know, every now and then I can find like they'll eat one bowl of cereal that doesn't have a ton of sugar in it. But this is fantastic because they, so far they're like three out of the four flavors that we got. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majorityreport and code majorityreport for free shipping. Also, today, one of our sponsors is BetterHelp. And they're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majorityreport. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists, it could take weeks or months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You're going to be talking to someone in less than 24 hours. Look, very stressful time for everybody. Obviously, not a time where you're going to go out and go see a therapist. Many therapists are already booked up. I can tell you my therapist, like now, you know, if I'm not on top of it, I got to book it out like 3 months in advance. This is also a great way to get introduced to the idea of therapy. Once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one. And you can do so at any time. You can do it for any reason. They don't, no charge. They don't ask questions. That's it. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majorityreport. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majorityreport. All right. Lastly, let's just get to this. This is pretty shocking that they can get away with this. But Ron Johnson's one of the dumbest people in the Senate. I'm sorry. That's just the case. He's ridiculous. But here he is with Martha McCallum on Fox News. And I can't even imagine that they think that people don't remember this. I'm shocked that they even, I feel like they probably don't know this, but I'm shocked by it.
You make a great point, because it's worth noting that this original Susan Rice email is stamped top secret. And, you know, when everybody looks at the contents of that email tonight, you might wonder why that would be classified as top secret. The other thing that I keep going back to is, if in that moment they have genuine concerns based on what has happened on these phone calls with Kislyak, they don't. You know, the biggest responsibility is to run the country responsibly and to make that transition of power. So if that were the case, that they were genuinely concerned that there was some compromise or something going on that was nefarious on those phone calls, why would they have not told the incoming president of the United States?
Because there's a corrupt transition process. No, that's exactly what they should have done. You know, the FBI defensively.
Do you understand what they're saying now? If they're aware, because they're releasing Susan Rice, because they're trying to do Obamagate, and this is just, they have lost a step on this one. This was somebody, whoever decided on Obamagate, really, I think, blew it. Maybe they didn't have any other options. But now they're saying that if the Obama administration genuinely had real concerns with General Flynn and his behavior, whether it was with the Turks or the Russians or whomever, why didn't they say anything? But I know that 80% of you listening to this, if you've been watching this show for the past couple of years or had any involvement in the news, are quite aware that Barack Obama famously, I mean, it was widely reported, sat down with Trump and said, "You got to watch out for General Flynn." And Trump didn't listen to him, but continue.
You know, the FBI defensively briefed Senator Feinstein when they found out that she had a potential Chinese agent in her office. They went to her quietly and said, "You have a potential problem. You should take care of it." That's what FBI should have been doing throughout the campaign and transition if they had any concerns. And President Trump could have addressed those concerns at that point in time. This didn't have to happen. Right. Again, it begs the question, what were they up to?
Well, apparently what they were up to was telling President Trump that Flynn was a problem. But put up the look at this. Here it is. This is from 2017. This is the 3 months into his administration. Obama warned Trump about Flynn, officials say. I think even Obama talked about it at one point. They had an Oval Office meeting. I mean, literally, just go to Google and just Google in there Obama, Trump, Flynn. There was like, it was widely reported. Politico, The Hill, Obama warned Trump about Michael Flynn during Oval Office. That's NPR. Obama warned Trump about Flynn, New York Times. Obama warned Trump about hiring for CNN Politics. Obama warned Trump about, say, officials, NBC News. I mean, Fox News, Martha McCallum's own. I mean, give me a break. It's crazy. But they're going to, before the inauguration. But what's going to happen is they're going to go down this road, and I don't see how they're going to get any traction. Like, they're so desperate to try and make this Obamagate stick. This is going to be fun to watch this. This is one of those things where it's like, this is not going to metastasize in the way that they think it is. I don't think, but we shall see. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. Just want to remind you, this program relies on your support. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you get extra content almost every day. Not today, but almost every day. And you get the fun half free of commercials. So you got that going for you. And you support the show. Also, you can sign up for AM Quickie. Last night, TMBS. Matt, who was on TMBS last night? Waz.
Lambre and Nando Vila. We had a whole full Woke Bro show. We talked a lot about the Michael Jordan documentary and a little bit about Venezuela and some other stuff. So good show last night.
So check that out. You can go patreon.com, TMBS, or the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Of course, Nomiki Kantz. Check out the Nomiki Show. You can do so at patreon.com, Nomiki, and also Nomiki Kantz on YouTube. The Antifada, they've got some new fresh podcast offerings in their feed. Check that out, patreon.com/TheAntifada. And what do you got going tonight for your Twitch stream, Matt?
Twitch.tv/literary hangover. Not sure what I'm going to play, but it might be this afternoon. So look for that,
folks. Ooh, okay. All right, quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser, and then we will see you tomorrow. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program senior correspondent from Vox, Ian Millhiser, to catch us up on some of the cases that have been argued in front of the Supreme Court this week, and I guess maybe last week. I should say we're recording this on Friday, so it really may be last week and the week before. And so, Ian, welcome to the program. These cases generally would find out the results sometime in June, maybe early July?
Yeah, so the court's normal practice is that they rush to get all the opinions out by the end of June. And some of that is just that the justices like to go on vacation in July, but that is the traditional end of the term when the justices push out all of the opinions. I don't know if that's going to be the case this year, though. I mean, A, because no one can go on vacation in July, but B, because a lot of these cases normally would be should have been argued in March and April. Because of the pandemic, they canceled the March and April arguments and then rescheduled them for telephone arguments in May. So the justices just have less time to write all these opinions and all these contentious cases that were just argued. And so I think there's a real possibility that we won't have the traditional rush of cases at the end of May. The justices might have to go into July or August before they're able to finish their work.
Okay, so things are all mixed up because of coronavirus, and let me ask you this. I mean, do you there's about three cases that we talked about going over here, but do you anticipate any cases? Are there any out there on a federal level? Like I know today, maybe it was yesterday, the Texas Supreme Court reversed, said, okay, debt collectors and evictors have at it now. And I guess it was 2 days ago, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, yeah we've decided in our medical opinion, it's fine for people to go and open up bars. Do you anticipate anything like that on a federal level? Or is it just that the Trump administration is not being aggressive enough that it would cause any Republicans to go and, I guess, say, hey, we need to be able to evict people or to allow them to, infect other people?
Right. Yeah, I sure hope not. I mean, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is an unusually ideological Supreme Court. It's an elected court. The elections, even though technically the judges don't run as Democrats or Republicans, everyone knows who the Democrat is, everyone knows who the Republican is, and they're very partisan. And the Republicans on that court are extraordinarily partisan. So I don't know that it's likely that many other judges are going to do what the Wisconsin Supreme Court did. I sure hope that we don't see a lot of that. One hopeful sign is there was a case that was just before the U.S. Supreme Court with the extraordinary name Friends of Danny DeVito v. Wolf. It's not the famous Danny DeVito, that guy who's running for the state Senate. But anyway, in the Danny DeVito case, this was challenging Pennsylvania's stay-at-home order. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court had allowed that order to stick around. Justice Alito asked for a bunch of additional briefing in the case, and so there were some fears that the U.S. Supreme Court might step in, and then the court just silently issued an order saying, nope, we're not stepping into this one. So the only signal we've got from the U.S. Supreme Court is in that Danny DeVito case where they seem to say, okay, we're staying out of this for now. And hopefully they will continue to stay out of this for now because we want these decisions being made by public health officials and not by lawyers.
Right. I mean, I just want to put a final point on this. The idea that a court, a Supreme Court, a federal Supreme Court, but any Supreme Court as far as I can tell, would contravene the government's findings about health in this situation seems to me, if you can find that, it seems to me that there is nothing that the government can do that is safe from this type of attack, right? I mean, because if you as a government can't have, and obviously you need to be able to make the case that we have a pandemic. You obviously can't pretend we have a pandemic. But if you as a government can't say, because of this pandemic, our scientists say we need to stay at home to protect the citizenry, if you as a government can't do that, according to a Supreme Court, how could you possibly say everybody should have health insurance? How could you possibly say really just about anything that a government could do could be overturned in this way?
Yeah, I mean, I think what underlies the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision is this broad anti-government ideology. If you read the opinion, the thrust of what the court is saying is it's saying that the order was the stay-at-home order in Wisconsin was handed down by the head of the state health department, who isn't an elected official, who is is appointed by the governor. And so the argument is this is just too much power to put in the hands of one person, especially an unelected official. And I mean, that is often a persuasive argument. But what I think a lot of these courts are, getting wrong is that, yes, like government power can be really scary. And the fact that we give a lot of power to individual government officials can be very frightening. I think anyone who's ever been subject to police misconduct will tell you that. But sometimes you need government. You know, sometimes you need the government to do something. I mean, imagine if there was an invading army. Is a court going to step in and say, well, you know, allowing this general to send troops to stop this invading army, that's just giving way too much power to this one unelected general? No. Like, I mean, government power can be really scary, but it doesn't take away from the fact that sometimes we need the government to act, and sometimes the government is the only thing that can protect us. And these judges, I think, aren't seeing this as a balance between two competing values here. The only thing they see is, oh, government's scary, we got to stop it.
Right. All right. Well, with that said, let's move on to the... Now that we're talking about the power of one individual, there were some really important cases that the Supreme Court heard this week regarding presidential immunity. Break those down for us.
Sure. So this is the lead case is Trump v. Mazars, which is the House subpoenaed Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, and then they also subpoenaed several banks, and they're seeking records, some of Trump's financial documents, probably including his tax returns. Different committees are seeking it for different reasons. I think the Intel, the House Intelligence Committee, wants those documents because they're concerned about the possibility of foreign interference in elections, and so they want to see if there's any evidence there of that Trump was working with Russian oligarchs, that he was helping them to launder money, or that there's some other reason to fear that there might be a Russian tie there that could have led to interference with the election. So this is, they're conducting this investigation. Trump doesn't want them to get the document, so they sued. And the legal standard, I mean, every case that you can read on Congress's power to issue subpoenas says that the power is very broad. Congress can issue a subpoena on any matter on which legislation can be had. You know, the idea is that if Congress is going to pass a bill, they want to know what they're talking about first. So they can investigate anything they need to know in order to inform the legislative process. And then, you know, if they're considering, like, how can we prevent the Russians from interfering in our election, they can gather information on that and then, you know, decide what to do with it. Trump stepped in and said, no, I should be immune from this. His Justice Department stepped in and said, no, the president is special and needs to give special immunity to the president. And based on the oral argument, I think it's likely that the court is going to say, yeah, the president is special. And the punchline is that we're probably not going to see these documents, if at all, for a really long time.
And I mean, what's the reasoning here? Like, how do they justify saying that, you know, these loans about Deutsche Bank or, you know, the accounting firm stuff is not relevant to oversight and investigations that the Congress is doing?
So their strongest argument is that, you know, basically the president has a lot going on and.
Really? Really, Ian? Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's their argument.
Theoretically, right? The president has a lot going on.
I mean, well, the argument, I mean, I'm trying to present it in the most sympathetic light. Yeah,
no, I know. I'm just giving you grief. Yeah. No, but yes.
Yeah.
Theoretically, yeah, a president has a lot going on. They're not, you know.
Right, and, yeah. The theory is like, you know, pretend that we had a president who doesn't spend his mornings live tweeting Fox News.
Right.
The theory is that the presidency is a very important job and the person who holds that office shouldn't be distracted by all of these investigations that take up a bunch of the president's time. And that's time that they should be spending, you know, doing things like fighting coronavirus. So that's the argument. There are a lot of problems with that argument. One problem with that argument is that it's been made before. It was made in Clinton v. Jones, the Paula Jones case. Paula Jones was one of the bit players in what became the Monica Lewinsky affair.
Right.
She sued Bill Clinton, claiming, I think, that he sexually harassed her.
Yep.
And the question in that case was whether Bill Clinton should be immune from civil suits. And Bill Clinton made the same arguments that Trump's Justice Department is making now, that, look, like, I'm the president, I've got a lot of important stuff I'm doing, and while I am president, I shouldn't be distracted by a civil lawsuit. And, you know, the Supreme Court didn't just say, no, you can be sued. The Supreme Court said unanimously, nope, you can be sued. And so, you know, maybe you think Clinton v. Jones was wrongly decided. Like, you know, maybe you look back on that and you say, well, gosh, like, that really did wind up taking up a bunch of Clinton's time because of being impeached. But it just seems extraordinary to me that when a Democratic president made that argument, the Supreme Court unanimously said, no, 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 you're not above the law. And when a Republican president makes the same argument, all of a sudden they're like, oh, well, maybe we were wrong about that.
And let's also be clear here. I mean, and I don't mean I am not downplaying the nature of what Paula Jones alleged here, but in our society, I think we have a fairly broad understanding that a civil suit is generally less urgent and less compelling than a criminal suit. Right. I mean, on some level. Right. And a criminal investigation. And that's what when they're looking for Trump's loans and perhaps money laundering and et cetera, they're in pursuit of something that is like criminal. And I can understand on one level, like if it's argued, we think this is just a fishing expedition. There's no rationale for what you're doing, or there's no legislative purpose for it. If they could prove that, that's one thing. But to say a blanket, no, this is too time consuming and there's no public interest in this. And I don't mean just by actual like entertainment value, but rather like a serving the public in some fashion is just, it's ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, and I'll point, I mean, like the line that everyone likes to quote is, you know, James Madison, the Federalist Papers, when he was describing the kind of government we would have, he said, ambition must be made to check ambition. Like the theory behind the U.S. separation of powers is that you have three separate branches of government and like, the people who are members of Congress are going to be ambitious. They're gonna want to get a sexy new job. And one way that they can get a sexy new job is if they're constantly investigating the president and like looking for stuff that makes the president look bad, because that benefits their selfish personal interests. And I mean, you may think that's bad. I mean, I lived through the Benghazi hearings. I lived through, you know, a lot of frivolous congressional investigations. But the job of a Supreme Court is not to say, well, you know, do I think it's a good idea for Congress to have this power? It's to enforce the Constitution we have.
Right.
And the Constitution we have was designed on the premise that it is a good thing that the President of the United States will constantly have to be looking over his shoulder if someone wants to take him down, and that it is a good thing that because people are able to investigate and people are able to frustrate the president might be more careful. That is the theory of our Constitution. And maybe you think it's wrong, but if you think it's wrong, you know, judge isn't the right job for you, because when you're a judge, you just have to follow what it says.
All right. And so, and again, we will know more about that. And a lot of this stuff is, you know, in terms of like, obviously this has relevance going forward into the future. Although I imagine if, you know, we have a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, they'll go back to the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court is constructed as is, they will find a way to make this happen now. And of course, we don't know the ruling on this, but this is going to have, if Donald Trump wins a second term, this is going to have big implications, right? I mean, because then all of a sudden it's like all investigations are off. I mean, there's no, you know, if we can't investigate anything, we can't investigate anything.
Yeah. So I should be fair here in that, like, I don't think that the Supreme Court is likely to say this investigation is shut down, there'd be no subpoenas, period. I think what the court is fairly likely to do is say, you know, like, the president has to have some extra protection, so we're going to lay out a bunch of new, never-before-stated protections that the president has, and now we're going to send it back to the lower courts, and the lower courts can spend months relitigating the case to see if these protections, you know, if the House has jumped through the right hoops and has overcome these protections. And it may be that after months or years of additional litigation, the courts finally get around to saying, like, oh, look, these subpoenas were fine. And, like, even with all the heightened protection that the president has, the House may still get these documents. But one thing that won't happen, I am almost certain of, is that none of that will be done before November. So, like, the practical effect of this Supreme Court decision is probably going to be that the voters go to the polls in November not knowing whether Donald Trump is colluding with the Russians, you know, not knowing whether there is evidence in these documents showing that he's been helping Russian oligarchs launder money for the last decade.
Well, I guess the good news is that we will have the resolution to these questions by the time Donald Trump Jr. Takes office, or at the very least by the time Barron is president. All right. Let's move on to, there were two over the past week and a half, two, how to put this, I guess religious freedom is how the right would refer to these things. For the rest of us, it would be about the second set of rules that is sort of expanding, it feels like, for people who claim they're religious or moral,
right,
for that matter. So let's talk about, one is the ministerial case. The other has to do with an expansion of the rights granted to Hobby Lobby to deny their employees birth control under their health care program. Let's start with the ministerial one. That one seems to be a little bit more technical than sort of like a broad-based principle.
Yeah, so these are really – the ministerial exemption cases are really difficult cases, and there's a great deal at stake in them. So the basic rule is that if you are a minister, you know, if you're a member of the clergy, if you're one of the leaders of your faith, then you do not benefit from civil rights laws. A church can fire its preacher for any reason it wants to. If the church doesn't like the fact that their preacher is black, they can fire the preacher because he is black. And, like, that's what the Supreme Court has said. But there's a lot of uncertainty about who qualifies as a minister. Because, like, so in the seminal case at the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court accepted that there was a ministerial exception, dealt with a teacher. And this was a teacher who taught both secular and religious subjects. She did have a lot of religious training. She did have, I don't know if she was formally ordained, but she like the court gave her a title, minister of the, or the school rather gave her a title, minister of the faith. You know, she held herself out as a minister. And so in those circumstances, the court said, yeah, this is enough. This school teacher qualifies as a minister. So she loses her access to civil rights laws. The cases that were argued on Monday also involve school teachers, but it's a much more marginal case about whether or not this person qualifies as a minister. So in one case, the woman taught religious subjects out of a workbook for 2 hours a day at a Catholic school. She didn't have any formal religious training. She was classified as a lay teacher by the school. So, like, basically the only thing she did that was in any way ministerial was 2 hours a day. There was a workbook on the Catholic faith, and she taught lessons out of it. And the school is now arguing that's enough. If you do 2 hours a week, spend 2 hours a week teaching religion, you're a minister and you don't have access to civil rights laws. So, I mean, I could go on for a long time about these cases. I think figuring out where to draw the line for who qualifies as a minister and who doesn't qualify as a minister is very hard. And, like, I'm not entirely sure where to draw it. But I think the court needs to draw a line somewhere, because what worries me about these cases is that, you know, if 2 hours of teaching religion is enough, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention put out a document saying that receptionists should be, like, their job description should say that they are supposed there to answer questions about the faith, because then they could be reclassified as ministers and then they wouldn't have the benefit of civil rights laws. You know, when I was a camp counselor, when I was 16 years old, twice a week I would lead what we called a devotion. It was like a 10-minute, like, give a life lesson to the kids and then end it with a prayer. So I spent 20 minutes a week doing devotions. Does that mean that I'm a minister and that I can't sue if they had violated my civil rights? So these are hard because I don't know where the line is, but it's really, really important that the Supreme Court draws the line, or you're going to see lots and lots of people become ministers and the civil rights laws will shrink.
What seems to me to be weird to me in this case is that I would imagine, like, there's a way of resolving this, and it's starts with, in their employment contract or agreement, that they're called ministers. And it also seems to me that, like, minister has to mean something within the context of their organization in terms and be reflected in terms of pay. Right. Like, I mean, so why can't I call all my people ministers?
Right. So what part of what makes it hard is that in religion cases, the court normally warns, it's called entanglement. Like, because of the Establishment Clause, you know, because the government is not supposed to be involved in religion, courts typically say that courts should not be, like, should not judge religious questions. So, like, it's not the job of a court to say whether Jesus is the Son of God. It's not the job of a court to say whether Catholics believe that a particular sacrament is important. It's not the job of a court to say, like, whether two people are validly married within the auspices of a particular faith. So courts are supposed to stay out of answering religious questions. And so part of what makes these cases hard is that the question of who is a leader in your faith, who is a minister, is a pretty quintessentially religious question. But on the other hand, if you, and I mean, like, Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch both suggested that that should be the answer. If you're a religious employer and you say that someone is a minister, then they're a minister. But if that's the law, then it's pretty clear what's going to happen. A bunch of employers are going to say, great, everyone's a minister. We don't have to follow civil rights laws.
And this is relevant for things like Catholic hospitals. This is relevant for things, I mean, the Epoch Times, owned by a religious organization, right? I mean, we could go on and on and on.
And the Catholic hospitals thing came up in the argument. I mean, like, there are a lot of nurses in Catholic hospitals, and, like, you know, I mean, some of them are devout Catholics, but, you know, like, the nurses will provide spiritual counseling to a patient who is worried. You know, they will, they may pray with the patient. And so if I'm a nurse at a Catholic hospital and a patient asks me to pray with them and I do it as an act of kindness, does that mean that I've now lost all of my civil rights because I decided to do this kind thing for this person who may be dying? I don't want to diminish how fraught these cases are,
right?
Because it is true that courts are very bad at making decisions like who qualifies as a minister of the faith. But in this case, the stakes are so high. We're talking about people losing all of their civil rights that, you know, the courts just have to draw a line somewhere.
Right. Right. Okay. Now let's just talk about the second religious freedom case. And I know we both got to get going here, but, The second one is an expansion. Hobby Lobby decided that if you are a closely held company, which yeah. means, it, you know, that you're not necessarily a public company, I guess, or even or depending on how, you know, how much of your ownership is a function of like family maybe or something. I don't know. You can maybe just remind me of what that determination was. But that and you're religious. You can then impose your religious values on your employees, at least to the extent that in terms of what you offer them for health insurance can be can basically break the law. You get a special exemption in the law and you don't have to provide stuff that you find is, you know, religiously unacceptable to you, like birth control, for instance. And I don't know why it can't be expanded for that, like, because I religiously, you know, have a problem with appendicitis operations. I think, like, you keep it in there. God wanted you to have an appendix. You keep it in there is what is my attitude. But now they're talking about expanding it to like not just a religious problem, but a moral one. Explain.
Right. Right. So these cases are a little different. So let me explain a bit of the history here, because like there's a lot of complex legal distinctions that matter. So Hobby Lobby involved an Obama administration rule that said that nearly all employers have to include birth control within their employees' health plan. And Hobby Lobby is a private company. It said, well, our owners have a religious objection to several forms of birth control, so we don't want to offer it. And we claim, because that's what our faith says, that we have a right to not provide birth control to our employees. And the Supreme Court agreed with them. And that was significant because up until that point, the court had always said that you couldn't use a religious objection to diminish the rights of someone else. You know, you could often say, like, hey, there's this law that burdens my faith. I don't want to follow it because of the burden on my religion. And frequently the courts would say, you're right, you shouldn't have to follow it. But the limit on that was that you couldn't use your own religious objection to take away a right from a third party. And Hobby Lobby eliminated that. But Hobby Lobby also left open the possibility, well, maybe there could be some other workaround we can do to make sure that these people who work for these religious employers still get birth control. And there were, you know, there was a whole new round of litigation about a workaround, and the court split because Scalia was dead, so they split 4-4 on whether that workaround worked. And then Trump got elected. And when Trump got in, his solution to the problem, his administration's solution to the problem, was just to say, well, the person with the religious objection always wins. So the Trump administration put out a new rule which said that if you have a religious or moral objection to birth control, you can do whatever you want. You do not have to provide birth control to people. You always win. That's what the new rule is.
Is it just birth control or is it anything?
Just birth control. So if you have a religious objection to birth control is the new rule, then you win. And then then you do not have to provide birth control to your employees. Or if you have a moral objection, which is its own can of worms. So what's interesting about these cases, at least, you know, to a law geek like me, is that there are two competing conservative values in tension here. One is that conservatives really like religious liberty. And I think, like, you know, if, you know, the Republican justices could pick the rule that they wanted, they would pick the rule that Trump came up with. But on the other hand, the Republican justices really hate the idea of administration officials handing down rules like this. They want to take a bunch of authority away from federal agencies. And there were quite a few questions from conservative justices saying, like, wait a minute, let's set aside the religious question here. I just don't think an agency should be making this call. And so, I mean, I still think that the court is likely to side with Trump here, but I'm not entirely certain. And because I think that they might prefer to use this as a vehicle to shrink agency power. And, you know, that opens up its own can of worms, because the reason they want to shrink agency power is nothing to do with birth control, and everything with, it has everything to do with preventing a Democratic administration from protecting the environment.
Right.
But, you know, I am less certain after listening to that oral argument how this case is going to come down.
Okay. So lastly, just let me ask you this. Like, why just birth control? Like, if we just defer to religion and we don't get involved, right. Like, you know, if we're not going to even, like, contemplate the idea that we get to say who is and isn't a minister based upon the way that you treat them and the way that they, you know, function as an employee of yours, which seems to me to be a secular dynamic, right? I mean, if you were truly religious, you wouldn't take any money, in my opinion, but that's just my religion. My religion also feels very strongly about this whole appendix thing. You know, I don't talk about it much because people mock me, but I feel strongly about this appendix thing. And why can't I? Why do I have to subscribe to the religious values of, let's say, Catholicism or Christianity when my religion says, got to keep your appendix in? Like, I don't understand. Yeah. Why do they get to choose in that instance, but not, you know, but like, why is that religion favored over mine?
Yeah. So I think the short answer to that is that, you know, it matters a lot what the individual justices who sit on the Supreme Court think about various different kinds of health care. So what I tell you what the law says, at least at the federal level, the law says that you can be exempted if you have a religious objection to a law, you can be exempted from it unless the state has a compelling interest in enforcing the law and enforces it in a way that's narrowly tailored to make sure it doesn't, you know, do too much harm to your religious belief. And so with that compelling interest standard, like, that's kind of vague. Like, you know, someone like Justice Alito might say, well, I just don't think that making sure that women don't get pregnant is that important. I just don't think the government has a compelling interest in protecting it ensuring that people have access to reproductive health. You know, if their appendix is going to rupture, I think that's really important. So they have a compelling interest in making sure that people can get appendectomies. But I just don't think that birth control is that important. And ultimately, that's what this comes down to. It comes down to whether individual judges look at birth control and they think access to contraceptive care is as important as any other form of health care, or at least as important as many forms of health care, or whether it's just kind of a frivolous thing and the government doesn't have that much interest in maintaining it.
Now, of course, if we didn't have such activist judges, they would allow the legislature to make that decision, right? Because that's a political decision. And when they put it in there, they put it in there in terms of defining, like, you know, what society at least or the government feels is a compelling medical procedure. But it doesn't work that way with the judges. And I know that in part because of my conversations with you, Ian, over the years. Thank you so much for your time. I will reconsider my whole appendicitis prohibition in my religion in the meantime. And I will get back to you on that in the near future.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Sam.